Korea. Very good. Okay, well, thank you all again for coming back for the third and final installment of Buddhist Physicalism question mark. We're no question mark this time, I see.
The question mark will be...
Oh, the question mark will come from the audience. Yes, very good. Okay, so now, in the final lecture, so Mark is then finally facing the hard problem, and we look forward to seeing how he's going to solve it by the end of the lecture. So, over to you. Thank you.
And thank you all for coming back. I apologize for the coldness of the room, which I realize I exacerbated. I'm told I exacerbated. I didn't feel it, of course, because for me, at least, philosophizing is a motor activity. So I walk back and forth and expend energy to keep myself warm. You, on the other hand, had to sit there and listen to this gobbledygook. And my example, I want to be faithful to Dharmakirti, who always uses blue as his example of a perception. And so I came up with blue ice cream. Brr. I wish I'd been able to think of some good thing to eat that's blue and also hot, but I couldn't. I'm sure just changed it to brown and talked about hot chocolate. Okay. There is still the question mark. I want to insist, because my job here is not to prevent Dharmageddon, prevent Buddhism from going the way of modern Western monotheisms when I'm confronted with a problem of living in a naturalistic culture. I'm just raising this as a possibility. I think it may be a viable possibility, but we'll see. And so I'm interested to hear what you all have to say. Now, to naturalize Buddhism means going beyond folk psychology. And of course, Buddhism itself does not accept folk psychology, but it comes sort of close. Obviously, a modernized, naturalized Buddhism would have to go beyond 6th century CE folk physics, but that is not necessarily a hard job. But the question for us, the question I want to discuss is, what about the... Okay, the Buddhists did not accept all of their... and culture's current folk psychology, because obviously any folk psychology is going to include a subject of cognition, and Buddhists uniformly reject the very idea of a subject of cognition. But the rest of it was more or less built around some common sense ideas about what goes on when we cognize. They did some very careful analysis of the role of concepts, how those interact with perceptual data, et cetera, but at least the starting point was folk psychology. Now, this is, here I'm taking issue with this notion of Buddhism as mind science. It is true that Buddhism, like modern cognitive science, modern philosophy of mind and psychology, rejects the model of the Cartesian theater, the mind as a place where these phenomenal states appear, and then there is the observer in the audience watching and taking it all in. Buddhists, of course, reject that. But there's still problems with the Buddhist picture of cognition. For one thing, what Kogsai tells us, at least there are problems if we're going to update in light of what modern empirical investigation of cognition tells us about it. One of the things it says is that consciousness is reducible. That is, it is explicable in terms of various and sundry brain events. Kogsai generally holds that consciousness is the posit of a useful theory. This is a nod to Kumarala, who came up with this account of metacognition, that in effect says, well, it's something that we suppose must be there in order to explain our observations. Here's something that, the orthodox view about cognition in the Buddhist traditions is it occurs at virtually every moment. There is no moment in waking life, there is no moment in sleep, even in dreamless sleep. It's only in certain highly advanced meditative states that there is any interruption in stream of consciousness. And that actually becomes a problem in various Buddhist accounts of mind. What Kogsai tells us is that it's only intermittently available, or we are only intermittently conscious, cognizing. If you don't want to accept my account of this and would rather, instead of turning to cognitive scientists, turn to a meditator, there is actually one person who is a meditator and also a cognitive scientist, Susan Blackmore, who has some very interesting things to say about her attempts to answer the question, am I conscious now? And it's very much worth your while, I think, to read her book, Zen and the Art of Consciousness. Really, really fun. It's an account of her it's almost a meditation journal, but it's full of interesting and important, I think, important information about what a meditator who is also a cognitive scientist makes of being in that situation. Okay, in order to dismantle the Cartesian theater, I'm going to have to reveal the illusory nature of consciousness. That's what the cognitive scientist would say, precisely because consciousness cognition is reducible, positively useful theory, and only intermittently occurrent. It's because of the fact that those features are diametrically opposed to the Cartesian theater, which is the folk model of how our minds work, diametrically opposed to that particular account. So how are you going to do that? How are you going to motivate what in contemporary philosophy of mind is referred to as illusionism due to Frankish? There's another term that gets bandied about, fictionalism. Precisely what the difference is between those two isn't really important for our purposes. I'm just going to use the term illusionism. What I'm going to suggest is that a Buddhist physicalist would have to be an illusionist, would have to claim that phenomenal consciousness is an illusion. And the obvious question is, how could that possibly make sense? Here's why that sounds just flat out wrong. What's an illusion? It's something that appears to us. Appears. That is, something that we are conscious of. An illusion is a conscious mental state, isn't it? So if being conscious is itself an illusion, there can be no illusions, it's self-refuting. Okay? That's the paradox that the thesis of illusionism runs into. And that's one way of thinking about the so-called hard problem. How, if you are a physicalist, can you possibly reduce consciousness to something that is not yet, not itself conscious? How can you explain the facts about cognition in purely physical terms, purely neurophysiological terms? the problem of explaining phenomenal consciousness, the problem of zombies, are zombies conceivable? But if they're conceivable, since we're not zombies, then and there's something that a purely physical account of us cannot explain, so we need to invoke something more than just the physical nature of human beings and their nervous systems. Now, here is one way of beginning to explore a possible way around that difficulty. This is the phenomenon known as blind sight. Anyone familiar with blind sight? One person. Okay. Here's a video of a blind sight patient. And now, am I going to be able to pull this off? Okay, this is a blind sight patient walking down. He's been told to walk down this corridor. Okay, his face is masked because, well, we want to honor patient confidentiality. Now, this man is blind. If you ask him if he sees anything, the answer is no. He does not see anything. If you ask him, how then did you walk down the corridor? His answer is, I walked straight down. Now, it's not what we see, obviously. What could possibly explain this phenomenon of someone who is blind, who reports himself to be blind, who reports himself as unable to visually discriminate anything, doing what he just did, walking around the various obstacles going down the corridor? Well, to understand what's going on in a blind sight patient, I need to take you into a little bit of contemporary accounts of cognition. The distinction between two different cognitive systems, systems one and two, they're called. Used to be called the dorsal and ventral systems, but turns out they're not exactly localized in the brain the way people originally thought they were. System one is a neural system in which sensory input goes straight to the motor control system. Motor control, that's efferent output. The nerves that and stimulate muscles and cause muscles to move in various ways. Okay. Now, system one is fast, efficient, and promotes the interest of the organism. Okay? It's fast because the input goes straight to, through system one, through some neural connections, straight to motor control, which makes the organism behave in a certain way. No diddling around. Okay, here's an example of system one in action. You're riding your bicycle down the usual path you take every day, and then you find yourself ducking. And it's only subsequently that you realize you ducked because a branch of a tree neighboring the bike path had been blown down overnight by the high winds, and consequently, if you just kept going on your usual path, that branch would have hit your head, so you ducked. And you might say, under those circumstances, I knew that branch was coming before I even saw it. A reflex, a ducking reflex. And that's a good example of System 1 in action. Doing something before you're even aware of the stimulus that would make it useful for you to do what you did. That, as opposed to System 2, System 2 is much slower than System 1. It's slower because it takes sensory input and posts that representation, that neural representation of that input, in something that cognitive scientists call the global workspace. It's like putting a post-it up on this board that everyone sees. Everyone in the office can see what you just put up in that global workspace. Now, who else is in the office? You get input through your sensory channels, and then there are various different mental modules that also have access to that global workspace. For instance, modules involved in memory formation and memory retrieval. Verbal modules having to do with verbal comprehension, verbal production, speech production, etc. And, oh yeah, fine motor control as well, okay? The ducking response, it does not involve fine motor control. It's just like that. You duck. This makes it possible, the System 2, because of the fine motor control, can take the information that's been processed after its reception in the global workspace and work out strategies for making use of that information to the advantage of the system as a whole. Now, the gatekeeper for this global workspace is attention. You have to attend to the stimulus, that is, focus on it, and that then, okay, when there is, when the organ, okay, the sensory system will be sensitive in particular ways to particular kinds of input, and that serves the function. That sensitivity can result in attention being triggered and that input winding up in the global workspace. Blindsight patients have suffered a certain sort of brain damage that results in visual input no longer being no longer having access to System 2, no longer being posted in the global workspace. The information coming in through vision only goes to System 1 and not to System 2. And that's what explains what's going on with the blindsight patient. What he says is, I didn't see anything as I walked down the corridor. I'm blind. I walked straight down the hall. I didn't weave around as we saw him do. I just walked straight down. Because, of course, I mean, why would I weave? I know how to walk. That's not my problem. My problem is just I'm blind. I don't see things. But you told me go walk down the hall. I knew which direction to go and I went. End of story. Notice this is what psychologists call confabulation. Ignoring the evidence of his own motor control system and interoceptive system, which tells him, should be telling him, that he weaves around as he walks down the corridor because I'm blind. Okay. And now his performance is not fast, it's rather halting. Now, in characterizing System 1 versus System 2, I said, well, yeah, System 1 is fast, it's efficient, it is not very fine-tuned. In this case, though, it is system one that is responsible for his walking as he did. So what's going on there? Well, answer, system one is not responsible for fine motor control. Okay. So there are two different ways in which a routine, a procedure can get included in system one. One is through natural selection, and that's where our reflexes come from. Okay, we have the ducking reflex because our ancestors, our pre-human ancestors, likewise, I mean, the ones that didn't, through luck of the draw, natural selection, have that reflex, they wound up getting hit on the head and not reproducing. So we have inherited the lucky ancestors who did have that reflex. So that's one way for something to wind up in system one. But the other way is through habituation. You do something long enough that may, in fact, require system two, like learning to drive. Those of you who have gone through that rite, it's an American rite of passage, it's not as common in Europe, that adolescents have to learn to drive. And it takes a lot of careful concentration, requiring system two. You have to listen to your instructor and think about what they told you about how you signal a left turn, a right turn, how you approach this curve that you have to go around, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? Requires lots and lots of memory retrieval, lots of coordinating vision and other sensory systems and so on. But eventually we acquire the habits that go to make up what we call being a driver. And it becomes self-habitual that it'd be really, really shocking to realize you just drove from point A to point B without even being aware of going there. I mean, the common story is you drive home from work. Before you get in the car, you remember, oh, I have to stop and pick up the dry cleaning on the way home. And then the next thing you know, you're pulling the driveway of your home without, in fact, having stopped at the dry cleaner. Okay, driving on automatic pilot. That's a case of a system one taking on through habituation something that started out as requiring system two. And I think of that as kind of sort of like what Dharmakirti is getting at when he talks about abhyasavatprajaksha, habituated perception. If you see something often enough and confirm that it is what you see, according to Dharmakirti, eventually you don't need to check. It becomes svata, intrinsically veridical, svata pramanya. And that's kind of sort of what goes on when a system one becomes the driver. Okay, now I already talked about this. A system one is only good at coarse-grained motor control, not fine-grained. The fine-grained that is involved when we walk around the pillar because we see the pillar and it's registered in the global workspace. So here's the question, and of course I wouldn't post the question unless I thought the answer was affirmative. Could phenomenal consciousness be a product of system two? Now, notice system two involves the parts of the brain responsible, mental modules responsible for speech production, speech comprehension. And so conceptual capacities are going to be in there as modules that can work on the information that's posted on the global workspace. Okay, so this Brown that is in front of me gets this Brown visual percept gets posted on the representation of Brown gets posted on the global workspace, and among other things, my speech production module is capable of recognizing that as an occurrence of Brown, and so I can say to myself, I see Brown, and that may trigger memory that's encoded in conceptual form. And what's associated with Brown? Well, one of the things that's associated with Brown for me is hot chocolate. And so I think, could that be hot chocolate? And I act on that. Okay? Well, that is a case in which we would ordinarily say, I am aware of seeing Brown. There is something it's like for me to see this hot chocolate in front of me. And that's what we're talking about when we talk about phenomenal consciousness. And that's the source of the hard problem. Could that be something that only comes out when system two is functioning, not system one? And one way to think about this is in terms of what's nowadays called the phenomenon of flow. Anyone familiar with that term, being in a flow state? It's, okay, the best example I can think of, not from personal experience, is the martial arts master, who in combat or in ritual combat does exactly the right thing at each instant as they engage their opponent. They move in just the right way. You see a martial arts movie and it's always intensely well choreographed to make it appear as if this person just instantaneously does the right thing at exactly the right moment. Now, we always wonder, how could anyone be that good, do that exactly the right thing at each and every step along the way of that choreographed dance? And the answer, of course, in the case of the movie, is they shot it many times and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But in real life, that sort of thing can happen, does happen. And how does it happen? Through habituation, through training, so that it becomes just simply a matter of course, that I will, in this situation, respond in this way, in that situation, respond that way. The sensory input goes straight to motor control due to habituation. And there is no posting of the sensory input, the representation, in the global workspace. There isn't time for that. Remember, system two is slow, system one is fast. Now, when I think of my own experience, the closest I've ever come to being in a flow state is when I used to ski, and I would be on one of these double diamond black trails, and at the top of the hill, looking down at all those moguls, very, very steep, and eventually I'd summon the courage and I'd just let go and I'd go down, and before I knew it, before I was aware of anything at all, I was at the bottom and I'd look back up. How did I get here? How is that possible? Well, in fact, at least sometimes, rarely, but sometimes, I had developed the skills to make it possible when there's this little mogul here, you go that way, and then that way, and that, blah, blah, blah. And it all happens too fast to even know what you're doing until you get to the bottom and you retrospectively reconstruct. Oh, I just did it. That's phenomenal. That's fantastic. But that's not, there is no phenomenal consciousness involved, not while you are going down that slope or engaging in that martial arts combat. So that's the suggestion. Now, there's another piece of the puzzle to throw in here from Cog's side, which is theory of mind, which they abbreviate as TOM. Now, a theory of mind is just a theory according to which a sentient being, like us, has covert states, hidden states, such as sensations, desires, feelings of pleasure and pain, beliefs, etc., to which that being has privileged access. You have your own thoughts about this garbage I'm spewing. I have my own thoughts about it, okay? And unless you articulate your thoughts, your feelings, I can't know. Your access to your cognition, your mind, is privileged, and likewise mine. We can only share through a public language. Now, this is a widely shared idea. This is what I was talking about earlier as folk psychology. And the Cartesian theater image is a way of modeling how this is all supposed to work. Now, the question is theory of mind something that is innate in each human being, that we just, our brains are just naturally, or our minds, excuse me, I'm being a physicalist now, I talk about our brains, our minds are innately from birth equipped with this theory that attributes minds to others and themselves, or is it rather a developed capacity? Well, here's how cognitive scientists have tried to answer that question by way of something called the false belief test. And this is a test that's performed on children, very young children, typically between the ages of 3 and 5. And there are two versions of the test. There's a third person false belief test, and then there's a first person false belief test. Here's how the third person test goes. You got two children, let's say their ages of 3 or 4 or 5, two children who are shown this interesting, intriguing toy, and then watch as one of the experimenters, one of the researchers, puts the toy in one particular drawer in this chest of drawers, okay? Now, child A, C, and child B both see the toy being put in that drawer and the drawer closed, but child B is then taken out of the room. While B is out of the room, A sees the researcher move the toy from this drawer to this other drawer. And then child A is asked, when B comes back in the room, where will they look for the toy? Now, when A is like 3 years old, they will answer, oh, they will look for the toy in that drawer over there. Not this one, but that one. It's only at about age 4 that child A is capable of saying, no, they will believe that the toy is over here. It's only beginning at about age 4, in other words, that a child is able to attribute to another child a false belief. Because, of course, the child knows that the toy is not there where it was first put, it's over there. But in order to correctly say what B will think when B comes back in the room, they have to attribute to B a false belief. Now that's an indication that the child has begun to acquire the ability to attribute to others mental states, things like beliefs. Okay? Before that, when the child said, oh, they'll say toys over there, they did not yet have command of the concept of belief. To have command of that concept, you have to be able to distinguish between true beliefs and false beliefs without having access to the information that the system you are attributing the belief to has. Okay? So that's a sign that children do not come into the world with a theory of mind. It's something they only acquire over time through, among other things, acquisition of language. Now, okay, I've just told you the results. Third person false belief test. Then there's the first person false belief test. Here, the child is playing with a toy, and then, exactly how this one goes. It's a matter of, okay. And the child is playing with this toy, and then the child is distracted. And one of the researchers takes that toy and conceals it in this chest of drawers. And then the child is shown a video of what just happened. They see themselves playing with the toy, and then they see someone, one of the adult experimenters, taking the toy while the child is distracted and concealing it in this drawer. And then, having seen the video, the child is asked, what did you think about? I got the details wrong. It's like the first false belief test. The child sees the toy being put in one drawer, but then the child is distracted while one of the researchers moves the toy from that drawer to another drawer. Okay? And then they are shown a video of what just happened. And then they are asked, what did you think before you saw the video? What did you believe about where the toy is? Once again, until the child can pass the third person false belief test, they're going to give the wrong answer. They're going to answer, it's where it really is, where the video just showed it was put while I was distracted. They are not yet able. Only after they can pass a third person false belief test can they pass the first person false belief test by attributing to themselves, before they saw the video, the false belief that the toy is in that drawer rather than that drawer. Okay? So, not only is it the case that the child does not have the notion of a false belief and so has full mastery of the concept of belief in general, which is a key component of theory of mind, but they only begin to think of themselves as having minds after they have come to think of others as having minds. Now that sounds crazy. That's completely counter to our intuitions. And one of our intuitions is that, don't infants, pre-linguistic infants, have a theory of mind? Don't they perfectly well know that, in fact, their caregivers have these mental states, and those mental states are what trigger their caregivers to act in certain ways? I mean, for instance, you smile at the infant and it will smile back, and isn't that a sign that the infant knows perfectly well that when you're smiling at him or her, they are, that means that they are likely to want to take care of you. Isn't that why they smile back? Well, not according to this account. What the false belief tests suggest is theory of mind is first acquired with respect to others and only subsequently internalized, applied to oneself. Now, this is in perfect conformity with the Autopody account of metacognition. Remember, Kumarala, we talked about this morning, claims that cognitions are states that we attribute to others and ourselves on the basis of the same evidence, namely behavior and speech. And this idea that acquisition of theory of mind is only something that comes subsequent to certain other important developmental hurdles is perfectly in conformity with that idea. Consciousness, in other words, is a theoretical posit in a theory that works well for us. Folk psychology as a useful theory. And theory of mind is, well, okay, it posits minds, that's what the M in TOM is, as fictions, useful fictions. It's useful for us to have a theory of mind because it allows the child to develop executive function. This is something that infants simply lack. Anyone who's cared for one knows this perfectly well. They're not capable of controlling their own behavior. Executive function is all about self-monitoring, self-control, self-revision. This is something infants can't do, something that small children only begin to be able to do as they acquire a theory of mind. Because executive function requires this idea of my mind as something that has these capacities that I can exercise. And this in turn suggests that perhaps the global workspace is where phenomenal consciousness occurs. But could phenomenal consciousness be an illusion? This is once again the problem, which I sometimes call the problem for illusionism, that consciousness would turn out to be the mother of all illusions. This all sounds absurd to most ears. And going back to the child, the infant, I mean, even infants learn, and isn't learning a conscious process? Well, no, not necessarily. I mean, we know this in a very, very forceful way through the development of AI. Unless, of course, you think that in AI, the AI system is conscious. But now I want to turn to a final strand in the story I'm trying to tell about why consciousness, why cognition might be an illusion, which has to do with language acquisition. I'm going to start out with that part of folk psychology that is the intuitive account of how we get language, and in fact, it's one that's very nicely articulated by the quotation from Augustine that we find at the very beginning of Wittgenstein's Philosophical Investigations. Of course, Wittgenstein spends the rest of the Philosophical Investigations basically trying to destroy that particular account of language acquisition, what language is. But according to the passage from Augustine, the child sees and hears adults around him, adult caregivers, naming objects and then moving toward those objects. And the child then infers that when they make this sound, that in fact refers to, that signifies this particular sort of object. And so, as the child hears words used in sentences, the child progressively learns what objects words signify, and in due course comes to use them to express his or her own desires. Okay? That's the Augustinian version of language acquisition, and it's kind of, sort of, intuitive. So what does this require us to say about the child? Well, first, obviously, the child must have concepts of these objects. They just don't know the names of those objects in the local dialect. And the child is capable of forming inferences. Oh, just uttered the term pillar and then started walking toward the pillar. That must mean that that sound is the name for that object. They can form those sorts of inferences. In other words, they think, but in a private language of thought. Now, what's wrong with this picture? Well, here's an alternative account of how thinking originates. It originates as inner speech. By about 4 or 5, a child is good enough at language that they can engage in conversational exchanges. They talk to their parents, they talk to their siblings, they talk to their friends, they tell stories, they listen to stories back and forth and back and forth. Okay? That's the first step. But children also start talking to themselves. It's kind of strange, it's kind of cute. They do it. And for instance, they might engage in a sort of dialogue with a pretend friend. Many of us had pretend friends when we were 4 or 5. And they'll talk to their pretend friend. But they'll also answer. They'll, in the voice of the pretend friend, or maybe in their own voice, they will not just ask the question, but give the answer. They will not just tell the pretend friend to do such and such, they will do it. They'll play both roles. Now, sometimes this talking, the child's talking to itself, can take the form of asking questions, and sometimes it can take the form of issuing commands, saying, do this, don't do that, or pay attention. And on the face of it, that seems sort of dumb. I mean, you ask a question because you don't know the answer. Why would asking yourself a question make any difference, give you an answer? And likewise for issuing a command, pay attention. Well, if the command was necessary, it's because the child is not paying attention. And why would we think that being told by itself to pay attention would make a difference? Nonetheless, this sort of practice can have results. It's interesting, it's sort of odd, only though odd if you think of the mind as a frictionless object. Because asking yourself a question can shake loose the information that you want, that triggered the question in the first place. And likewise, you hear the authoritative tone of the pay attention order, and that can trigger paying attention. You've heard your parents tell you often enough, pay attention. If you say it in the right tone of voice, well, might have that response. Now, this is all happening in overt speech. This is how children begin. They talk to themselves out loud. But then eventually they discover that you can do the same thing privately using covert speech. not making the sound. And that is what we call thinking. The child begins to think through this process of internalizing overt speech. Now, what that suggests is that thought is a developed capacity. It's not something innate to infants. Infants do not think because they haven't yet acquired the linguistic and conceptual resources that are required to think and the habits that go with speech production and speech comprehension. That's something that only happens over time through their exposure to a public language. The whole point of the private language argument of Wittgenstein was precisely this, that the very idea that private language, which was at the heart of Augustine's model, is incoherent, makes absolutely no sense. It attributes to the child conceptual resources it could not possibly have. Thought is only a developed capacity. Now, this fits in very neatly with the global workspace model of phenomenal consciousness, because the global workspace requires executive function. And executive function only develops in the child this ability to control itself, to engage in self-monitoring, self-control, and self-revision, those three crucial properties. It only develops those after it has acquired a theory of mind. And how does it do that? Through development of linguistic capacities. This is also where autobiographical memory becomes possible. Why do none of us remember experiences any earlier than about age 4? Answer, we didn't yet think. And why didn't we think? Why didn't we have the capacity to thereby encode our experiences using our conceptual repertoire? Answer, we didn't yet have the conceptual repertoire. We only acquire that through acquisition of concepts through exposure to a public language. And this is what in the end installs the eye sense, the ahamkara. There are various syntheses involved that the Nyayikas, for instance, insist can only be explained if you suppose that there is a self running through all these different cognitive episodes. And those syntheses in fact develop through the development of the global workspace. Now, what makes all of this sound initially very bizarre and clearly absurd is we have this, folk psychology, Augustine was more or less reflecting in a somewhat stilted way, but nonetheless was in fact in tune with this idea that, of course, babies are conscious. Of course, they have thoughts. They just don't know how to express them. Well, in fact, we all tend to behave as though we think babies are conscious. Babies think. Why? Because if we didn't, they never would think. There's a kind of mechanism of self-fulfilling prophecy at work here in a human psychology. The child will not develop any of these, the linguistic capacities, and consequently acquire a theory of mind and develop executive function, etc., etc., unless they are exposed to a public language. Now, when we talk to a baby, what do we think we're doing? We're communicating to the baby. We attribute to the baby the capacity to at least recognize that we are on its side, we're there to take care of it, blah, 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 we're nice, friendly creatures, etc., etc. And it's only because we think the baby is capable of grasping at some level what we are doing, that the baby is in fact exposed to the kind of linguistic prompts that eventually lead to its acquisition of language. It won't think unless it acquires language, but it won't acquire language unless we think it's already in some sense thinking. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Oh, that baby has a mind, it's thinking. I don't know what it's thinking because we can't communicate, but it's thinking, and so I will treat it as a thinking thing. And the upshot is, by treating it that way, it acquires language and so becomes able to think. Okay? That's the picture. Inner speech fosters a kind of doubling or mirroring, because inner speech is still speech, and speech is always dialogic in form. There's the speaker and there's the listener. Now, in the case of the child talking to itself overtly, the speaker and the listener are one and the same. And likewise, when the speech becomes covert, becomes inner, and turns into thought, there are always these two elements involved, the speaker and the listener. Now, what that means is acquiring the ability to think, that is, to engage in inner speech, involves a sort of doubling. The speaker and the listener, a mirroring. And mirrors are, as I said this morning, a stock example of something illusory. The mirror image is an illusion. It's not really real. So the suggestion is that inner speech is precisely what's responsible for the construction of the Cartesian theater with these two elements, the spectator in the audience, and then the images of being projected onto the screen. And there is the speech producer and the speech consumer. And now, if you want qualia in this story, notice something. Think about not the the visual system, but the auditory system. The mechanics of the theater's sound system. How does that work? Well, when we think to ourselves in inner speech, there's some hot chocolate coming. Okay, the Ford model, this is part of action theory, how cognitive science understands the neuroscience of action. When you intend to perform an action, what you do, what your brain does, is produce a copy of the kind of input that you would get if that action were actually performed. In the case of the action of moving your hand, the kind of, okay, I'm going to move my hand, I'm going to reach for the computer. Forming that intention means producing a forward model, which is an attenuated version of the sensory input I would get upon execution of that command. That's what they mean by a forward model, the expectation of what it would feel like. And in the case of inner speech, it's the expectation of what I would hear when I think a thought. Now, when the thought is, the question, what am I going to talk about tomorrow? Then the question, the forward model of the asking of the question triggers the standard response when you hear a question of looking for an answer. When I think to myself, consider it, pay attention, the forward model is going to have that imperative tone of voice that I'm so used to hearing from my parents that makes me want to do what they say, which is pay attention. So there are what the qualifier calls phenomenal properties involved in the formal model, which is part of what's triggered by inner speech. And so anything that goes through system two is going to produce the illusion through this doubling of qualia, of phenomenal properties that are in here, not out there. That's the illusion. And that's why consciousness is, says this sort of physicalist, an illusion. Now, okay, that's my shtick. That's my response to, that's the Buddhist, excuse me, not me. That's the Buddhist physicalist response to the hard problem. But having been a teacher for many, many years, I want to end by posing questions for further reflection. Does this dissolve the hard problem? Can there be Buddhism without karma rebirth ideology? And what about the rest of, what about the overall soteriological project that is Buddhism? Could this survive naturalization? And a couple of you asked for the reference when I said that Vasubandhu thinks Charvaka, this materialism, is in fact conducive to liberation. In fact, he doesn't say Charvaka, he says Uccheda Drishti. But Uccheda, that's the view of annihilationism. The view that it's the YOLO, you only live one life. It's that view. And the only YOLO folk on the scene when Vasubandhu was writing were Charvaka. But he says that that's mokshanukula. Okay, it's conducive to moksha, to liberation. Okay, and the reference is, it's in the commentary on 5th chapter, 19th verse, and in the Pradhan edition is 290-291. Okay, so for those of you who are interested, that's the reference. But back to our questions for reflection. This is the, I've talked enough, this is the part where you talk.
Great, well, thank you very much. So, comments, questions, either regarding those questions or independent of those. We have some time to discuss these. Yes, Jacob.
Thank you for the talk. There's a few different questions, but I'll try and package them together as one question. So I wasn't sure how we could do away with queria. Usually we say queria are produced by someone to provide explanations of how they're useful. How does this mean that they're not real? So they might be useful, but that doesn't mean they're useful fictions. And they might be produced, but that doesn't mean they are not real. And then a couple of small comments. Theory of mind and thinking both seem to be slightly different targets than phenomenal consciousness. So even if we provide an explanation for why these are developed with certain functions, that doesn't necessarily mean that phenomenal consciousness can be treated.
First question is exactly the one that I expect to hear, and so thank you for posing it. And because I realized that my presentation today by itself will not persuade very many people who are qualiophiles. The thought here is that belief in qualia, belief in phenomenal consciousness, is in fact just a redescription. It's a sort of imposition of theory of mind on our own states. It's a subsequent description of what's actually going on. It's one feature of System 2 that's central to this whole story is precisely the fact that it allows for what we ordinarily think of as reflection. It's actually just processing, additional processing of the input, the stimulus, by these different systems, using various, among other things, conceptual linguistic resources. And the theory of mind that we have acquired along with these capacities, which is, I want to stress, a very useful thing for us to have. It's useful for us to think of ourselves as having minds, because that allows for the development of executive function, which is crucial to socialization. I mean, we know what happens in adolescence, and we know how much of that has to do with not yet sufficient mastery of executive function. And so we have this theory of mind that sees this process with this output of action, but also this process of attenuated forward commands in the motor control system. And those forward commands are themselves, can themselves be, when we try to engage in introspection, reflected upon as hearing voices. And of course, to hear a voice is, the qualiophile would say, to have a representation with phenomenal content. Excuse me. So theory of mind, including this idea of thought as an inner performance, leads to our under, at least when we are theorizing about cognition, leads us to attribute to the mind these states of phenomenal consciousness. But that's always retrospective. It's a kind of confabulation, even.
Does it need to be false? I mean, does that mean that it needs to be false? If you have these ways of attributing certain properties, what makes them false? Could it be that we are correctly recognizing a feature of our minds, meaning that there is normal consciousness?
I'm sorry, I'm not hearing you.
So, in your arguments, I think you said, does that mean that we are wrong when we attribute phenomenal consciousness to ourselves, or could it be that we are doing so with good reason, and that there is, when we use these terms, we are picking something out that is real? And
it is conventionally true that we have phenomenal consciousness. Theory of mind is a useful thing. And theory of mind includes this idea that we have these states of phenomenal consciousness. So you could even go so far as to say that they call it all conventionally real. But Buddhists aren't interested in what's conventionally real, they want to know what's ultimately real.
Right. Yeah, I was just thinking, what do the arguments lead towards? Do they force us to say that the quality of unreal, or could we also interpret the arguments in a different way and say it's useful, and perhaps it's useful because it corresponds with how things are? Or, I mean, are we forced in the unreal?
This is where, once again, the appeal is going to be to the
rich. And this whole thing is driven by this idea of autophagy, of what's the best explanation of the phenomenon. But the best explanation in particular in terms of entities that we can understand as being ultimately we. Okay. And remember the point I made this morning about what exactly is the intrinsic nature of a cognitive state. And if you want to follow the non-determined purity, you're going to have to say that the qualia are, in fact, intrinsic to that state. But then you've got the problem of the subject-object dichotomy, saying, oh, that's just beginningless ignorance. Well, to say, to explain something in terms of beginningless ignorance sounds to me like a confession, I don't really know how to explain it. Put all my hands. We've always thought that way, so. But we were wrong. Whereas this can presumably explain. And so you've got lightness on the side of this, but you've also got a better explanation of the phenomenon itself, something that Dignaghan. And Dignaghan and Domenicucci were right to think that there is an illusion involved in the subject object, the grahya grahaka distinction. That's ignorance. But the ignorance comes into the picture on this story by way of the theory of mind that involves the idea of thought, but what is thought in speech. The mirroring involved in being both the speaker and the listener. Because that's what's going on in inner speech, in thought. Okay. That's the Buddhist physicalist would say it's a real clincher in this response to the whole problem.
Right, we've got one question here, and then
I will try to make a coherent question slash problematization. I can see in what you presented. I can see with Jacob that theory of mind doesn't lead by itself to the consciousness being a product of the system too, that it needs the inner speech being the consciousness or the presenting consciousness. The problem I see is that in cases of child, there's much discussion on what's going on with the language, because we have cases of children that are non-verbal. We have also, in the adults, called cases of aphasia, who present non-speaking, non-writing, apparently no language, but they have thought. There is the supposition that they have thought. So I wonder if it is not a very strong imposition on children and on the whole picture of consciousness, it being an inner speech, because language and consciousness seem very, very strongly related, but it doesn't seem that speech, the consciousness leads to necessary speech. Also, how can one explain children receiving the language as such velocity, as such fastness? Do we then take a kind of innate universal grammar language like Chomsky's one in order to explain that there is, because then we are presupposing that there is something in mind that is structured before having inner speech. So I think there is some kind of wiggle things in there.
I'm not going to get into Chomsky's innate universal grammar. Just not going to go there, sorry. But I will concede that we have to attribute to the pre-linguistic infant certain cognitive mechanisms, certain neural mechanisms that make speech acquisition and all sorts of other behavior possible. Okay, I mean, Wittgenstein flirted with philosophical behaviorism in the transition from Tractatus to the Investigations. it isn't quite so prominent in the investigations. It is quite prominent in the Blue Book. And that's actually where my own philosophical career began, when I read the Blue Book and realized that what Wittgenstein was doing might in fact be a better way of representing this non-self stuff than what I had encountered in popular discussions of Buddhism. I was just a freshman, I was just 19 years old, 18 years old at this point. But in fact, that's what turned me on to philosophy and studying Buddhism in through the lens of a philosopher. Behaviorism has a bad rap, but it does at least concede that there have to be certain mechanisms that make possible this sort of learning of behavioral routines that then get bootstrapped into acquisition of a more sophisticated use of language that then leads to acquisition of a theory of mind, blah, 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 the whole story. And I don't think we're selling infants short. I certainly don't want to sell infants short, because remember, the self-fulfilling prophecy says if we want our babies to turn into responsible adults, we can't sell them short. We have to act as though they've got minds of their own. Now, they do have minds of their own, of course, in one sense. I mean, and you know what is, those of you who are parents know what it's like to be awakened by the screaming infant at 3 a.m. And that's obviously a mind that is not your mind. It's, yeah, they're quite strong-willed. But we have to think that there's more to babies than that in order to nurture them in ways that will lead to language acquisition. That's the basic claim. And I think this is pretty much agreed upon among developmental psychologists. And so the self-fulfilling prophecy is actually an important part of folk psychology. And folk psychology is what leads to opposition to the kind of story I'm telling, and instead supporting the notion that, well, the baby might not be able to label this particular brown color, but it does nonetheless understand in its own private language that this is brown and also smells like chocolate, and so num num. It's useful for us to think of babies that way. Because if we think of them that way, we treat them in ways that we might not otherwise. We might instead treat them the way we treat farm animals. And babies would never turn into members of society. And then we'd be in deep doo-doo.
Okay.
Yes, thanks for the talk. I want to ask whether the argument about doubling, or rather mirroring, necessarily commits us to physicalism. In other words, do we have to call that ultimate reality out of which we emerge with a sense of interiority, a conventional sense of interiority, and attribute that sense of interiority to other beings? Is that necessarily physical? Because I don't necessarily see that being a necessary consequence of the argument. Are we equally justified in calling that ultimate reality a ground, or whatever other term I want to use?
I mean, Yogacara could tell a very vastly different Yogacara could tell a similar sort of story, just using karmic seeds in place of the firing of neurons. And so they could say, well, in fact, you don't need to posit reflexive self-awareness, fascinating, in order to explain cognition. You don't need to go down that road that leads to violation of the principle of irreflexivity, et cetera, et cetera. All you need to do is tell a story about inner speech that mirrors what the physicalist is saying. You don't need physicalism to tell this sort of story. You need some sort of ultimately real entity, some dharmas. But whether they're physical or non-physical, well, if you can point to the kinds of causal laws that govern how this dharma is succeeded by that dharma, and on the basis of those causal laws explain why it appears to us that, et cetera, then fine. But, and the suggestion on the part of the Buddhist physicalist is, look, it's by assuming that there is a physical world, there are physical entities, there are the sorts of things that physics and the other natural sciences study, that we get this robust picture of how things are. The one thing that some people think must be left out is the mental stuff. And then the Buddhist physicalist, any illusionist, will come along and say, no, you can explain that stuff too, and telling the sort of story I'm just trying to. And so, yeah, you don't need to be necessarily a physicalist to tell this kind of story. It's just that, you know, we're living with the products of the explosion in knowledge of the natural world. That strongly suggests that the natural world is quite real. So why not, given the problems, accounting in ways that are consonant with Buddhist metaphysical scruples, why not tell a similar story about consciousness?
So is Buddhist physicalism upaya in that sense?
Hmm?
Is it like upaya in that sense that we're trying to use the stories that we tell ourselves at this particular stage in our cultural development to ultimately set people down the Buddhist path?
Yeah, the question is everything upaya? And Majjhimaka would say, sure, it's all there is. But a Buddhist metaphysical realist, and this includes Yogacara and all the Abhidharma schools, as well as Buddhist physicals, is going to say, no, it can't be all upaya. There has to be something that makes adopting this view more useful, more conducive to liberation than adopting that view. There has to be something that drives the agenda.
Right, can I have another question?
That's where I'm tempted to bring in this flow stuff. Because what happens in the flow state is there is no mirroring, there is no me, there's just straight input and output. Sensory input, motor control output. And that's all. And you get to the bottom of that double diamond black trail, and there's that sense of exhilaration. How cool! How incredible! Maybe that's what it's like to be enlightened. It's not just that there's no more existential angst. Maybe there's actually something positive as well. I mean, we hear in pop accounts of Buddhism all this stuff about living in the moment. Well, maybe that's what's really going on there. We are, in fact, not having these intrusive, this intrusive overlord of the mind constantly intruding, questioning what's going on, and couldn't you do better, blah, 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 and where is this all going, we're all going to die anyway, etc. It's all gone. That's the thought. I think that might be the right way to think about the point of liberation in general, whether you're a physicalist or a Yogacara idealist or an Abhidharma dualist. I'm influenced in part, I was recently in Kyoto and at the National Museum, they had an exhibit of the treasures of Tofukuji, which is a very old and very important Buddhist temple. And the chief treasure of Tofukuji is this depiction of the 500 arhats, the Gokyaku Rakka, by Mincho, who is a 12th century painter. And what's fascinating about his depiction of the arhats, so many of them are smiling, they're so happy. You don't always see this in depictions of arhats. But in Zen, they take the arhats seriously. See, of course, a lot of Buddhist iconography that we're familiar with is Mahayana stuff, and they don't want to talk about the arhats at all because they are selfish. You have to want to be a bodhisattva, and then you're constantly, you know, throwing yourself off the cliff to feed that hungry tiger, etc., etc. And that's not a whole lot of fun. The arhats are depicted as having enjoyment in life. That's what's so clear in Mincho's depictions. It's really, really cool. And that's what suggests to me that maybe this is what it's really been all about from the outset.
Right, I think we have time for one last question. Thank you.
Thank you. So building on that, I was wondering whether therefore you might be forced to accept that animals experience this kind of enlightenment. And in that case, it doesn't seem like they just experience bliss as you were describing the
animals. Yeah, animals certainly don't suffer from existential angst. That much is clear. Non-human animals, I should say, because we are animals too. Are they in a liberated state? See, I'm not sure what to say about that. I suspect not. Perhaps some of the bliss that can come with being in the enlightened state has to do with release. And the non-human animal is not released from dukkha, from existential suffering, because it never experienced it in the first place. It just, you know, goes through the day doing what it needs to do. Sometimes it experiences pleasure, sometimes pain, sometimes indifference. But it doesn't reflect on those because it doesn't have system two. Only linguistic animals will develop system two consciousness. And so have that capacity to reflect, will internalize theory of mind and come to see themselves as thinkers, experiencers, cognizers. Non-human animals don't, I think.
Great. Well, thank you very much, and please join me in thanking Mark for three fascinating lectures.